What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin along with John Krawczyk. And John, I think we really need to take our hats off to teachers across America. It's pretty remarkable what they're doing. I mean, their patience, their persistence, and their adaptability to these unique classroom situations that we find ourselves in because of COVID-19, don't you?
Well, my hat's off to them, but I think they're struggling. I think kids are struggling. I think teachers are struggling. A lot of them have kids at home, so they're dealing with that. Online issues, bandwidth issues, and I think there's a lot of struggling going on, too, between students and teachers right now.
Oh, I agree with you totally. But I always thought, John, that teaching was hard. I substitute taught a couple of times. And, well, substitute teachers don't get a lot of respect, I'll be honest. But it's tough being up there every day. I mean, we think it's tough when we were doing a radio show, John, preparing every day for an audience. But that audience wasn't staring me in the face. That audience perhaps didn't come to me, and I knew it, with a lousy breakfast, and they couldn't concentrate, or they had all their things going on, and I could see in their eyes that they weren't engaged, and you had to find a way into their hearts and their minds. That's a tough job, no matter what the circumstances.
Oh, yeah, and I think it's tougher because I think it's harder to read kids and even young adults online to see if they're actually getting this stuff and if it's sinking in. You know in the classroom you can tell when things are going right and when people are struggling and you can help them out, but I think it's harder online.
Oh, I agree. In fact, I taught a college course once, John, and nobody wanted to take this course except it was a gut course. And so they persevered, but I could tell their disinterest in the history of public broadcasting. They weren't that interested, John. I know you find that shocking, but they weren't. But I've got to tell you, John, you know, I spent a lot of time now at the dog park, as you know, and I've talked to some teachers there who are doing this hybrid adaptation. So you have some students in front of you, others you think are at home, but you're having a hard time figuring out what environment they're working in. And all the things that you talked about at the beginning in terms of their connection, in terms of the noise and the ambiance of what's going on at home, makes it almost an impossible situation.
I agree. I think, we need to somehow get back to school. But, I mean, we're going to have to use, I think in the future, we're going to end up using both. But I think we got to find a better way of doing it, and I'm not sure what that is.
Well, I think we may have that for you today on the podcast, John. But I just want to say one thing, that the newly named Secretary of Education federally, he's been designated by Joe Biden, Miguel Cardona, is from our own state of Connecticut. He's the Commissioner of Education. And I worked for a commissioner of education about seven removed from Miguel Cardona. And it's a thankless job, I must say that, being a commissioner of education and really trying to have an impact on 169 towns and cities. But he's evidently done a good job. And one of the reasons that Joe Biden picked him was that he really has a preference, a real desire to get kids back to school.
I think that's important, I saw that on the news, and it seems like it's a very good pick, and hopefully he's right. We can get kids back to school, because that's where they need to be, really.
And by the way, John, he'll get little complaint from our guest today, Justin Reich. He's a professor of comparative media studies and the director of Teaching Systems Lab at MIT. Now, you would imagine, John, given his credential, that he would want all the technology you could muster for the learning experience. That's what you would believe, correct?
That is, you're right. MIT, that's all technology.
Well, the subtitle to his book, which is called Failure to Disrupt, the subtitle is Why Technology Alone Can't Transform Education. And John, I think it's fair to say that this pandemic and the ways we've had to adapt demonstrate that pretty clearly. But how do we fold technology into the mix? We'll talk about it today on America Trends. Here on America Trends, Justin Reich is our guest today, and he's written a book called Failure to Disrupt, Why Technology Alone Can't Transform Education. And Justin, just in time, a book like this, obviously we have discovered all kinds of things as it relates to distance learning and massive online open courses and all kinds of things during this period of the pandemic. What is the lesson that we should take away from what we've been experiencing to date?
I think education technology enthusiasts have made two kinds of wrong arguments that we should be on our guard against. And the first argument is that technology is like a bulldozer. It sort of can sweep away whole sectors and lead to new futures. And that might be true in some other sectors like journalism or dating, but schools are complex, they're conservative, they're made up of lots and lots of little interlocking parts, and they don't change very readily. And so the technologies that we have for schools, they're not like bulldozers, they're like little pegs that fit into particular holes. And technology, learning technologies are not like switches that you can flip on and off. You can't sort of download new software to students' computers and go, oh, let the learning start. Learning technologies are only as useful as the communities who guide their use. And so when we use new technologies, we need to provide support for teachers, for students, for families to figure out how to use them better. And, of course, that's been enormously difficult during the pandemic because the pandemic did flip our lives like a switch. But our learning doesn't work that way.
Well, many teachers, we were told before all of this, were very reluctant to change from standard procedures. Perhaps many had lesson plans that were still in writing, pen, pencil, whatever it may be. They like to use the blackboard. And of course, I'm not going to dismiss how important the interaction is between the teacher and the student in class, not virtually, but they had to ramp up so quickly. Now, that was last year. And then there was some forewarning that many were going to have hybrid approaches, many were still going to be virtual. Are we getting it any better over time? Because that's a lot to ask somebody to transform their entire learning style from what they're used to for the last 10, 15, 20 years into something that is quite foreign to them.
Especially when we know that learning to teach better and learning to teach better with technology is a developmental process. It's not something that happens instantaneously. If you had asked me in January of 2020, you know, how long does it take a teacher or a group of teachers to get better at a thing, to get better at teaching their kids to sort through information online or to use technology for formative assessment? I would have said, well, the research suggests that it usually takes about 40 hours on average for teachers to get better at things, you know, 40 hours of professional development and collaborative planning, and it takes a period of months to practice, try new things, and so forth. And that's for one thing, not for completely transforming your curriculum. But I've been unbelievably impressed with the devotion and dedication of America's teachers. All of the ones that I talk to are just working incredibly hard, staying up late, you know, doing their replanning.
Absolutely.
And they're going to get better at it. But they're not going to get better at it instantaneously. They're going to get better at it over time. And so hopefully what we're doing in October will be better than what we did in September, and we'll keep making some progress. I will say that looking back, one challenge or one missed opportunity from this summer is that in a lot of places, school systems ask teachers, we need you to prepare three different plans. We need you to get ready for fully face-to-face, we need you to get ready for hybrid, and we need you to get ready for online. And we're not going to tell you which one of those we're doing, you know, sometimes until, you know, in New York City, we still don't know which of those things that we're doing. It's very hard to ask teachers to make good lesson plans if there's no school plan.
It's interesting because for more informal education, would you agree with me, Justin, that for some of us, I'm one of these adult learners, if you will, and I taught myself how to play keyboard, and now I'm writing songs and doing all kinds of things, and it's been over a 3-4 year period, and I haven't defined the right teacher online. I mean, there are many courses, tons of courses that are available in these open settings like YouTube, but there's only certain teachers who still, whether they're in person, in your face, or online, that can really reach you with the content.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're hitting on one of the most intriguing puzzles and paradoxes in online learning, and I bet your listeners will resonate with them as well. Almost all of us in the networked world have things that we like to learn online, whether it's, you know, makeup and hair tutorials, or I've been teaching myself mountain biking this fall and keep breaking things, and I've been watching a lot of bike repair videos, you know, how to turn when you're going downhill. When there are things that we're really passionate about, when we're really interested in, many of us find ourselves very successful online learners, and this is true for children down into adolescence. You know, there are lots of really young kids out there who are learning amazing ways to build things in Minecraft from Minecraft tutorials and forums and things like that. And yet, when we look at online schooling, I think many folks are quite frustrated and disappointed with how things are going, because it turns out that as fluent as we are in learning the kinds of things that we're really passionate about online, many people find it difficult to learn the sorts of things that the state or school systems want us to learn online. Online learning is a lot easier than online schooling, and much of it comes down to motivation. If we're pursuing the things we care most about, then we find ways of connecting with the right teachers, the right resources, as you say. When it's something that we're just supposed to do, it's really hard to maintain that motivation in the absence of the peers and the human teachers that keep us connected and focused and attentive in physical schools.
Not only has Justin written this book that we're talking about, he's also the Mitsui Career Development Professor of Comparative Media Studies and Director of the Teaching Systems Lab at MIT, so he knows of what he speaks. It's interesting, speaking of another esteemed professor, I've had his proteges on for different books that they've written, and he has since passed, but you quoted Clayton Christensen, who really understood disruption in so many industries. And he predicted, before his passing, of course, that by 2019, half of all middle and high school courses would be replaced by online options. What did he get wrong?
Well, I think people who are really enthusiastic about technologies and education technologies, they tend to ascribe tremendous power to the technologies themselves to rearrange social systems. But in lots of sectors of society, technologies are not more powerful. They are not transformative of the systems they go into, because the systems are built by people with complex interests and conflicting needs. Clay Christensen developed his theories in marketplaces, and schooling systems are not marketplaces. They're public goods. They're public services. And I think they're also quite good critiques just of the theory of disruptive innovation in general, you know, probably best summarized by a New Yorker article that Jill Lepore wrote that suggested that education is not the only sector in which Clay Christensen's predictions turned out to be incorrect. Christensen's core argument and idea was that technologies could disrupt existing systems, classrooms, in the cases of education. But it's really better to understand education technologies as being domesticated by existing systems. Schooling systems are really good at taking new technologies, new ideas, and saying, they're not going to change everything that we do, but we're going to slot them in right here. Massive open online courses, you know, they were predicted to create all these new entry points into higher education and lead to the unbundling and the rearrangement of higher education. And they're basically used now to support the development of new kinds of professional programs and professional master's degrees. And that's a reasonable thing to do, but it's a particular niche in higher education, you know, that the system managed to go, okay, you're not going to change everything we're doing, but you can fit here.
You say that large-scale learning environments can be classified into different genres. Explain to us what that means, and some are related to sequencing for learners, instructor, or algorithms by a peer. Explain these differences.
So one of the goals of the book is to make it so that educators and families and communities can look at new technologies and go, the person who's selling that is really enthusiastic about it, and they're telling me that this is going to be really transformative and really different this time. Like, we know that MOOCs and adaptive tutors didn't do everything, but let me tell you about AI and data science and VR. Like, this is really going to be the new thing this time. And I want readers to be able to look at new technologies and say, most of this is not new. At best, there's some incremental change here, but just about all new technologies exist in lineages of older technologies. So in the book, in the first half of the book, I talk about large-scale learning technologies, technologies where they're trying to support many, many learners with few experts to guide them. And there are basically three types based on the answer's question, who sequences the learning experience? So there are things that are sequenced by instructors where they put a linear path of different learning experiences together. And then learners generally follow that path. That would be what a massive open online course would be like. There are technologies where a computer sets the sequence of learning experiences based on the performance of a student. And those would be algorithm-guided learning experiences like adaptive tutors and intelligent tutors. If you've used Khan Academy's practice problems, they're like that. And then there are large-scale learning environments in which peers create a series of learning experiences, and then people navigate through these peer communities. That would be like the Scratch programming language that's widely used in schools and in all kinds of informal settings. And, you know, these three genres, they tend to have similar kinds of pedagogical ideas within the genres. They have similar kinds of technologies that they use. You know, people selling adaptive tutors sometimes come out and say, oh, we have all this data, we have all these brand new kinds of things that we're doing, and if you sort of pull open the hood and look inside, you'll say, oh, you're using item response theory. This is a statistical toolkit that was developed in the 1980s by the Educational Testing Service. There may be all kinds of bells and whistles here, but we know how far you can go with the technologies that exist. And what it lets us do is to say, okay, this thing is an algorithm-guided learning experience. We have a whole bunch of research on how they've been used in schools, where they work, where they don't, who they work for, who they don't work for. So we can take a new entrant and say, okay, maybe you've made some little improvement here, but based on what I'm seeing, we'll probably see similar kind of results as we have for the past 30 years of using these kinds of tools.
Well, you remind us in the book that this whole project of teaching people with computers is at least 60 years old. I think people would be very surprised to hear that. I was just reading this Bloomberg opinion piece, and let me read it to you and get your reaction.
Sure.
The shift to remote learning during the pandemic has seriously harmed America's school children. The end of in-person instruction last spring reduced expected learning gains by an estimated 50% in math and nearly one-third in reading. With the vast majority of schools in urban districts still closed, low-income students are losing ground they might never make up. How do you react to that?
There are a bunch of different pieces there. One is that predictions are only that, predictions. We don't actually know what's happening yet. It will take us a while to figure out how people are learning. A second thing is to absolutely celebrate the opinion author's concern about inequality. Young children are resilient. There are going to be lots of young people who bounce back from these schooling challenges. But it's a lot easier to bounce back from these schooling challenges when you're well-fed, when your parents have work, when you have a safe place to live, than if you don't have all of those opportunities. And certainly one of the things we're seeing during the pandemic is yawning gaps in our social welfare services for children and families with children, and I hope it's something that we address. And then maybe
broadband and computer access?
It's an enormous issue. I hope one of the things the pandemic reveals is that we've treated broadband as a luxury good, and we need to start treating it as a utility. And we need to try to make sure that every family, especially families with children who are in school, have access to broadband so that they can participate in remote schooling. You know, this is not going to be the last disruption that we have to schools. With the growing, increasing effects of climate change, there are going to be more pandemics, there's going to be more severe weather events, we're going to have more interrupted schooling, and we need to build systems that are robust to that.
The book is called Failure to Disrupt, Why Technology Alone Can't Transform Education. Justin Reich is with us. You talk about charismatic initiatives. We've all heard of these things. Even in the state of Connecticut, where I live, Ray Dalio from Bridgewater, one of the big hedge fund companies, he wanted to invest about $100 million and try to get all the technology up to speed in urban districts. The whole thing as a public-private partnership fell apart, but we hear often about these, somebody's going in with this immersive activity that is going to bring technology to Newark or what have you. And yet you look at yourself, rather than these charismatic things, as more of a tinkerer, trying to input technology in appropriate ways to enhance the educational experience, but not to upend it.
Yeah, schools are complicated places, and, simply dumping a bunch of money into technology isn't going to, in and of itself, make teaching and learning better for students. Actually, so at MIT, I teach undergraduates, and I've taught them for a number of years now, and one of the things we do in classes is ask them about their ed tech experiences, and right now I'm getting the smart board generation come through.
So
10 years ago, there was a huge investment in schools in these whiteboards that could project image on them and have markers could sort of record the writing and things like that. And they sort of swept across the country as this new technology that was going to, provide new ways for teachers to communicate with students and so forth. Districts spent enormous amounts of money on them. And over and over again, my students tell me, yeah, they bought these things, and we just use them by whiteboards, as whiteboards. Nobody used the technology features of them after a while. I think it's a kind of classic technology-focused initiative, like buy it and new things will happen, because very, very few of these technology purchasing initiatives are accompanied by a similarly scoped investment in teacher learning. New technologies are only as valuable as the communities who guide their use. It doesn't, in lots of these places where people are spending hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars putting new technology in, they're not spending hundreds of thousands of dollars providing professional development for teachers, making more opportunities for collaborative time, creating spaces and opportunities for people to say, well, how should we shift the classroom around? How should we shift our schedules? What other kinds of changes do we need to make to take advantage of these new ideas? Technology can be a powerful catalyst for those kinds of conversations, but all too often, the conversation begins and ends with, what is the thing we're going to buy?
Let's go to the four dilemmas that you have outlined. The first dilemma is what you call the curse of the familiar. When technologists create novel and innovative new tools for teaching and learning, educators and students often find them confusing and hard to adopt. Is that what you were just addressing in our last segment?
Well, I would actually say the curse of the smart board is kind of the worst of both worlds. So part of the curse of the familiar is that most technologies that get into schools replicate existing functions. Even in the cases where smart boards would have worked to their fullest potential was just broadcasting, you know, displaying information to students. We have generations of technologies to display information to students. We have blackboards and whiteboards. We have acetate projectors, LCD projectors, all kinds of things that your older listeners will remember multiple generations of. And it's not like the new technologies provide that much of a substantial improvement. You know, there's only so much to be gained by kind of, improving the way that we show lecture notes to kids. But those new technologies, if they replicate a function that already happens in schools, teachers go, oh, I know what to do with this thing. You know, I put it at the front of the room and I show my lecture notes to the students with. By contrast, when people create technologies that do allow for different kinds of interactions between teachers and students, that sort of, you know, provide new pedagogical ideas, reframe the ways teaching can happen, lots of times that novelty makes them confusing. So the challenge is, how do you build things that could really create new kinds of teaching and learning opportunities without making them in ways that people look at them and go, oh, that's unfamiliar, I don't want that thing. And there are typically sort of two solutions to that challenge. So there's an online graphing calculator called Desmos. And on the one hand, it's a free graphing calculator, does everything a Texas Instrument TI-84 does. And so it starts, when you first start using it in a class, you can find lots of familiar ways of using it. But because it's, web-based, there's all kinds of simulations and modeling and demonstrations you can do with it. There's, you know, a whole sort of pathway of new innovative approaches to math teaching that can happen. And so it's a tool that starts in a familiar place, but allows you to go into new, interesting pedagogical territory. And at the same time, Desmos has a whole team of folks that travel all over the country or are now connecting with people virtually, creating communities of teachers that are thinking really carefully about what the future of technology-enabled math learning could look like. Their chief academic officer, Dan Meyer, has talked to math teachers in all 50 states. So their goal is not just to get every school to download Desmos and then to call it a day. Their goal is to continuously engage with the mathematics teaching community to say, what new opportunities are out there for us to do teaching and learning with technology and mathematics? And it's that kind of community building that needs to scale, not just the distribution of new technologies.
I want to get back to your dilemmas, but because you raised the issue of math, is it important for online learning? Because I'm thinking about creative writing. I'm thinking about other things that are so much more subjective in the teaching and learning process. Is it better to use technology when there's a way to very substantially assess what's going on and do it in the most objective manner? Is that one of the tools that's really helpful when you have that kind of assessment capability?
Well, I think there are lots of technologies that are organized around that. This connects with one of the other as yet intractable dilemmas, the trap of routine assessment, which is that if we want students to do self-paced, individual, personalized kinds of things online, then we need to provide them some feedback about how they're going. But if everyone is doing everything at their own pace, then we need computers to provide that feedback. Computers can only provide that feedback in domains in which computers are good at assessing things. And, you know, we've only built good auto graders in a few different areas. They're good in math. They're good in certain parts of science where you can compute all possible answers to a problem, like building an electric circuit or something like that. There are some great tools for auto grading in computer science. We can write computer programs that can evaluate other computer programs. There's some pretty neat things in language learning around pronunciation. But, you know, as you can tell from my sort of idiosyncratic list here, it's uneven. There's some areas we can do this well, and as you point out, there's lots of things that we want people to learn in which we don't have good auto graders. Probably the most important domain is around writing. We don't have the ability to evaluate whether or not people are doing a good job reasoning from evidence, which is kind of the main thing that we teach people how to do in schools. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean that all technologies that there's no kind of learning technology to support writing and learning. You know, for instance, there are fan fiction communities where young people around the world are writing millions of pages and developing all kinds of new skills with writing. So we need to say, okay, we have auto graders in certain areas. That's going to help us do certain kinds of things in certain subject areas. But it's not going to mean that we can have a whole self-paced curriculum for any autodidact to study anything they want. And then in these other domains, we need to think about what other kinds of technologies, maybe things that connect people more with peers or allow for creative expression that needs to be evaluated by other human teachers to be able to flourish.
Okay, so that gets to the third dilemma. So I'll go back to the second, but the third, which he was just discussing, is this whole notion of automated assessment, and computers can't assess many of the most important things that our students are learning. Let me go back to the second dilemma, which you did touch upon earlier. You call it the EdTech Matthew effect about disparities. I mean, kids don't just come into a classroom with a backpack. Many kids are carrying a much heavier load than others, so the impact on them, when in fact they might feel a little bit estranged from the learning process and don't have a lot of supports at home, makes those disparities greater and may widen those disparities instead of closing gaps.
Yeah, I think people for a long time have hoped that new technologies could democratize education, to use a phrase
right,
which is really common. My colleague Larry Cuban has a book, Teachers and Machines, in which he's got a great photo of a bunch of kids standing around a radio receiver. It's one of those old ones that's like the size of a small child. And the caption is, with radio, the underprivileged school becomes the privileged one. And the idea in the early 20th century was that, hey, with radio, we can now just have the world's best lecturers beam classes in by radio, and everyone will benefit equally. And of course, you know, you and your listeners know radio did not democratize education, and any of the new technologies we develop also not going to democratize education, because to use new technologies requires certain kinds of financial, social, and technical capital. If we want to solve the challenge of the yawning immoral gaps in learning opportunities between our most and least affluent young people in this society, that's political work. It's not technological work.
Let's go to the fourth dilemma. I don't want to get into politics right now. The toxic power of data and experiment highlights how new technologies are powerful platforms for research and A/B testing, which can be used to dramatically improve computational systems. Help us to unpack this.
Sure. Although I'm afraid it's going to get us into the realm of the political as well. You know, one of the
okay,
kind of amazing things that schools do is they take deeply political questions and they sort of tame them into technical ones. I mean, there's nothing more political than the question of how should we raise our children. And communities have, you know, widely divergent beliefs on that question. And, you know, in our local school boards, we, for the most part, get together and sort of negotiate solutions to those problems, which is not perfect for everyone, but seems to kind of work for the community. But periodically, and the introduction of new technologies can cause this, these sort of debates that appear to just be technical, like what's the best way to teach people, turn out to be political. What do we believe and what do we value? So one of the things that we can do with new technologies, especially these web-based platforms, is we can collect lots of data about how people use them, and we can run lots of experiments on them. You know, every time you go to Google or Amazon or Facebook, you know, 1% of the visits that you go there, you're being tested on some new feature. You know, they make the buy button green instead of blue, or put the link at the top instead of the bottom. And they test these things out on 1% of people, and if it makes you buy more stuff, then they use it for everyone. We can do the same kinds of things in education. The difference in education is that you nominally sort of freely visit Amazon of your own accord, but if you're compelled to go to public school and then we require you to use some kind of online platform, it wasn't really your choice as an 11-year-old to go there. And to what extent should we allow private companies to collect massive amounts of data about our students' learning experiences? To what extent, you know, as a researcher, I really like the idea of conducting experiments to make better technologies, but understandably, there are many parents and families out there who don't like the idea of experimenting on their children. And so, you know, this is another dilemma that we have have to face, probably the most substantial part of the dilemma is if we, you know, all of these tools to improve, to work, require collecting lots of data, and collecting lots of data about people can sort of inculcate them into a surveillance society. And it may be that that's not the function that we want public schools to play. So these are all, you know, dilemmas that are sorted out sometimes with sort of technical questions, but I think since they're about our values, you know, they're very much political as well.
You say, by good fortune, some of our best learning technologies are adaptive tutors in elementary math subjects. Have we really zeroed in on where a lot of these technologies, both supplementing or really taking over, can be the most effective? And is it on an elementary level? Is it middle level, high school? Have we gotten to a point where we say, ah, it really works in this realm, less so in another realm?
I think there's a body of research across these three genres that we talked about before that gives us some good guidance about where things are likely to work and where they're not. You know, as an industry of the field, we've built a lot of kind of gamified adaptive math tutors, and there's some evidence that some of them work okay. We've done the same thing with adaptive reading tutors, and the evidence for them is much less good. You know, it's also not just by subject area, but also sort of by people, too. So there are some folks that are really self-motivated, independent learners who kind of learn well anywhere. And those people typically can learn really well through online learning programs, even not particularly well-designed ones. You know, if you're the kind of learner who thrives anywhere, you'll thrive online. And so, you know, trying to figure out where things fit is, it has to do with grade level, it has to do with subject area, it has to do with kids and how they are as learners and what kinds of supports they have. So there are, you know, places in which that matrix we have more confidence around things. But of course there's still lots that we don't know about the best ways of combining human teachers and online learning experiences to make great schools.
You talked about political choices. It sounds like a lot of what we might do with technology going forward will cost money, particularly if we're going to be training teachers up because of all of the uncertainties that you talked about with climate change and perhaps more pandemics of the sort that we're experiencing now. So how do you incentivize teachers to develop online courses, mentor fellow teachers? Is there an approach that you've seen that you think works?
Yeah, I think the best approach draws on research that a colleague of mine at MIT, Peter Senge, has done, in which the kinds of schools and districts that do the best job of continuous improvement on these accords, they see themselves as learning organizations. They see themselves not just as people who are trying to, you know, teach students, but as organizations in which, in doing the work of the firm, they're trying to make sure that everyone involved is continuously learning and growing. And, you know, we as a society need to invest in that. We need to invest in our teaching force as a set of professionals. You know, I mean, when this career was developed, it was mostly unmarried young women who were expected to move on when they got married to homemaker life, and then they would get new young folks to take over. That's not a career ladder and a recipe for, you know, having the best possible chance of educating young people to solve the tremendous problems that we'll face in our future. So I think there are ways of thinking about taking on these challenges that we know about, you know, and there's certainly lots of schools and districts that we could point to where we say, look, this is a place where teaching and learning gets better year after year, and thoughtfully incorporating technology is part of that process of getting better year after year. But there are no breakthroughs. You know, that work looks like tinkering. It doesn't look like making things better through one fell swoop. It looks like getting 1,000 things a little bit more right year after year after year.
In closing, Justin Reich, let me ask you this. We have been thrown into this maelstrom, if you will, of online learning, and a little bit unprepared, of course, and some people very reluctant, others just not sensing that they really have the same relationship with their students. I've talked to teachers. They're very confused at times. They've got one kid in front of them, and they've got 20 kids at home, and they don't even know who's really there and who's paying attention. So it's something of a mess for many. So as you go forward, as you look at this, because we deal with trends on this podcast, where do you think we're going to be in the next 5-10 years? I know that this got Clayton Christensen and others into trouble trying to predict, but as you look forward, what do you see happening?
Well, I make safer kinds of predictions. You know, I actually wrote a piece around 2008, a little bit before Christensen's book came out, which said school systems will largely stay the same because they're tasked with balancing a complex set of stakeholder expectations. And they actually do a pretty good job of delegating, you know, of balancing all the interests of different, you know, teachers and families and communities and businesses and governments and so forth. So what do I think the future will look like? I mean, I think as soon as we have a vaccine and effective public health measures, people are going to flock as soon as they can back to physical schooling. In the best of all possible worlds, there will be lots of teachers who have experimented with new kinds of technology, new kinds of online tools, and they'll bring some of those tools back into the classroom. You know, their in-person teaching will be improved. If there are more snow days and more disruptions, we'll be more robust to those changes. Young people, maybe they've fallen behind in, you know, what the state said they were supposed to learn in math and science and reading, but I think they've also learned a tremendous amount about communicating with technology, about organizing their own self-directed learning. So I think, you know, we should not minimize the missed opportunities of this pandemic, but I think we also celebrate all the resilience that youth have shown. And we will continue to see in the decades ahead steady growth in different forms of online learning, steady growth in incorporating technologies into schools. We won't see disruptive transformations of these systems, but we'll see the kinds of trends that we've seen over the last 60 years of trying to use computers to teach humans continue.
Failure to disrupt. Why technology alone can't transform education. It's a question that I think a lot of people have on their minds, and you've done a lot to help us think it through, perhaps in a way that people had not considered. Justin, thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, very glad to be here.
America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.